me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words.
Yeah.
Baby, kiss me.
There you go. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday, everybody. Yeah. That's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Get your requests in now. We'll play them a little bit later. Coming up, it's the 50th anniversary of the first episode of The Brady Bunch. So we're going to talk about the Brady Bunch and some of the best sitcom TV families of all time. And we got conspiracy theories to talk about as well. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text for any time you want to jump in. Right now, though, if you've got a question or a comment or a concern or something about the world of space, now's the time to call or text, because we're going to be talking to Rod Pyle. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Our guest right now is author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society, and great guy all around. That would be Rod Pyle. Let's welcome Rod to the show. Hey, Rod, how you doing?
Good, Nick, and good morning to you, and you're an even greater guy.
Oh, come on now.
No, really.
I appreciate you joining us, and as always, we would like you to give a little background for people who might be new to the segment. Tell everybody who you are and how you got to be the spaceman that you are.
The spaceman. So I was born about the same time NASA was, a little earlier, but not too much.
Yeah.
And grew up with that during the space age, with that golden era going on. So by the time I was 10 and 11, they were heading off the moon every couple of months, and it was really an amazing time to be alive. So I was galvanized by that. Not really interested in sports, I'm sad to say, at least not like my friends were. And always wanted to do something with space, but if you've seen pictures of me, being an astronaut is not in my future for a bunch of reasons. So after kind of not doing so great in science in college, I mean, I took years of it, but it wasn't clicking. Like, I knew I was going to be at best an average astronomer or physicist, but I hoped I could do better in the creative side. So that's when I got off into TV, and I worked in documentaries and educational films, visual effects on Star Trek, then started writing space books in 2005, and that in the magazine is all I do now, and apparently a little bit more TV, because I'm shuffling back in that direction again.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. Well, we can play a little catch up here after we do the 1:30 news. We're going to jump into. We got a lot of space stuff to talk about, and you did see Ad Astra, the movie.
I did, because of you.
Yeah, and I didn't see it.
Which is why.
Oh,
you didn't?
No, I didn't.
So I got to hold the spoilers back.
No,
now,
you can say whatever you want to say, but I'm really curious as to what you think of it. And what I know about it is that it's not what it seems as advertised. What people are telling me, it's a lot more esoteric and kind of heady than you would expect, like a Brad Pitt space adventure to be.
Yeah, it's kind of like a psychologically deep, high concept Jerry Bruckheimer film with a lot of pouting in it.
Well, listen, when we talk about Ad Astra, the movie, a little bit later on, tell us about Ad Astra, the magazine.
Okay. Oh, tell you now?
Yeah.
Oh, Ad Astra, the magazine is the magazine that I edit and write for the National Space Society. They've been in business since the mid to late 70s, started by Wernher von Braun and then merged with an organization called the L5 Society. It was started by a Princeton physicist named Jerry O'Neill, who was big into space colonies. And they've been going strong ever since. The magazine started in the 80s, I think, and I've been doing it for about 2.5 years, I guess. And it's a big project for a really small crew, but it's a lot of fun, and you've seen a couple of copies of it.
Yeah.
You know, it turns out well for
a
small, moderately funded effort. And, it just so happened we heard this movie's coming out, same name of the magazine. I'm thinking, oh, man, there's a real PR opportunity here. But, you know, we're a little nonprofit. You can only do so much. But, yeah, we're getting a little extra attention. And we've been handing them out at theaters here and there throughout the country.
Oh, that's smart.
Because it just made sense. Yeah.
That's smart. And what I just realized what Ad Astra means. Tell everybody what Ad Astra means, what it translates
to. The stars
yes.
in Latin.
In Latin, to the stars.
Yeah. Kind of inspiring, isn't it?
It's very inspiring. You know,
Every now and then, you know, people kind of look at the cover sometimes and go, Ad Astra, what does this mean? And once you explain it, they go, oh, okay, I get it. But it does take a minute to explain it.
Yeah, and that's another thing about the movie itself. Like, some people are like, what does that mean? Like, just, you know, like, this is a mainstream Hollywood movie starring one of the biggest movie stars in the world, and it's called Ad Astra, and it's called Ad Astra, and it's just confusing people, I think, a little.
Well, and it would have made so much more sense to say, I hate my daddy, you know? But I guess they didn't figure that was going to be compelling enough.
That's not going to be. I don't think that's going to put butts in seats. So Ad Astra, really. But by the way, you guys do a great job with that magazine. You do it. It's really wonderful.
It's a blast to do, and one of these days I got to get you to write an article on why you like Interstellar.
It's the monthly mention of Interstellar.
Monthly harassment of Nick. Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
well, but you can always bust me for, you know, liking that other movie.
Well, you know, it's funny because, like, my old producer Dan Chigrou was also a big fan of Interstellar, so I had somebody in my corner. My producer now is Tom Hush, and he can't stand Interstellar. So,
now, is it because of the movie or is it because of Matthew McConaughey?
It's because of the movie. It's not good, man.
No, it's a great movie.
I thought the real Matthew McConaughey was the one he portrayed in Contact.
Ah, well, that could be.
You know, kind of schmucky, you know, religious zealot that ruins everything. Yeah.
Ruins everything and wears scarves in every scene.
Yeah, was probably driving a Lincoln town car when he left, right?
That's right. After doing a billiards trick, that's the thing.
Yes.
So,
yes.
All right, Rod, hang on, all right?
Okay.
All right, cool. Rod Pyle is with us. The monthly harassment of my love for Interstellar. I still stand by it. I think Interstellar is a great movie. A great movie. Perhaps Nolan's best. So, Tom's just shaking his head. All right, Rod Pyle is with us, and we'll get back to it and the conversation here. And if you want to jump in, we got a lot to talk about. But if you have some space questions or concerns or stories, it's 312-981-7200. And we'll be back after this and after the news right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live here in the Skyline Studio on 720 WGN, downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. And, there you go. You can get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Okay. Rod Pyle is with us. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and a space expert. And if you have any comments or questions about space-related issues, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Get them in now. Let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
All right. So the Area 51, the whole Area 51 raid thing happened last week. But for people who are not as familiar, when did the Area 51 thing... When did it really start? Like, what?
I think the guy first posted the thing in June 27th, a guy named Matty Roberts, and it was, depending on who you listen to, is either a tongue-in-cheek gag or a little bit of performance comedy. But, you know, he kind of didn't see what would happen, and then, you know, within a month, a couple million people say, I'm going, and another million or billion and a half said, I'm interested. And you know how it is with those things on Facebook or wherever. They say they're interested, and it's like, yeah, they're not coming. But, you know, a couple million people said they're going to come, and the Air Force, who runs this area out in Nevada, this test range, said, no, you're not. You better not.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the signs from it, it's like, back off. No photography, no drones. Deadly force is authorized. We have motion detectors in the ground. We have cameras everywhere. We got satellites trained on this place. Go away. And the CIA didn't even verify the thing existed until 2013. So it's kind of a spooky area, and I don't think you want to go crash the gates. That said, I guess it didn't really come off as planned.
Yeah, no, it didn't. It really didn't. When did the whole alien association thing start with Area 51?
So the area was set up as an auxiliary landing strip in 1942, and then 1947 was the Roswell incident, quote unquote, in New Mexico, where this supposedly saucer-shaped thing came down and crashed or landed and was trucked off to Area 51. And, you know, the official report says, look, it was a spooky-looking weather balloon-type thing that we were using to spy on the Russians and listen to subsonic signals from nuclear explosions and, you know, try and steal their nuclear secrets. But if you're more prone to looking for conspiracies, a lot of people thought, nah, this is a UFO and you captured a couple of recovered a couple of alien bodies. And over the years, we've all seen some evidence of that, probably faked, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that, you know, that's where they're hiding everything. So they wanted to go find out.
I've always thought the Area 51 thing was kind of like hilarious, but also interesting in that, any conspiracy theory, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories later on in the show. But I always find find conspiracy theories to be sometimes ridiculous, but many times fascinating. Mostly because of how many people buy in.
Well, I was going to say the fascination for me is how much energy goes into it, and we've talked about this before. I think part of it is, you know, if you kind of have an interest in science fiction, futurism, that kind of stuff. And you want to be kind of important, you can either go to school for a lot of years and pay a bunch of money and get a master's or a doctorate in some field that lends itself to that. Or if that's not quite your strut, then you can be like me and write about it instead because it's easier than learning all that stuff. Or you can watch YouTube videos and read internet articles and just decide that, you know, the spooky stuff is true. And I think that makes a lot of people feel kind of special, you know, and it's the same reason I like NASA, frankly. It's being part of something bigger than you, a movement, a belief system, whatever. Mine happens to be, you know, I think science is amazing enough by itself, but if you're of a different kind of mindset or you don't trust the government, then this becomes really appealing. What I think is kind of cool about Area 51, so it's this big salt flat, you know, it's crap land out in the middle of Nevada.
Right.
That nobody in their right mind would want. But and I think the nearest town is like 100 people. You know, it's tiny.
Yeah.
But it's also called a bunch of other names. One of them is Dreamland. And I remember years ago when North American Rockwell was trying to get the B-1's bomber signed off on, as I recall the story, the Air Force is saying, you know, it's not stealthy enough. It's got too big a radar signature. So supposedly a couple of Rockwell pilots took the thing up and did an unauthorized low-level pass over Area 51 just to prove that they wouldn't be able to spot it easily. And I think it had the radar signature about the diameter of a dinner plate or something. But what a cool thing to do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can't verify that, but that's the version I heard. But I know they worked on the U-2. The NASA version of the SR-71, the B-1 bomber out there. So they've done a lot of kind of sneaky stuff out there, and that's what it's for. You know, it's the big classified testing zone.
Right, exactly. I want to talk about this, Storm Area 51, they can't stop all of us thing and how it really went down. But what are some of your other favorite Area 51 related stories? Do you have any over the years?
Well, that one I think was my single favorite just because it's such a hot dog pilot thing. You know, I don't really keep that much track of them because it's not something that I'm very invested in, but there have been people I know that have tried to take ATVs and dirt bikes up to the fence area, and they kind of, you know, get chased off by the black helicopter crowd and they come back, or sometimes it's guys' Jeeps. I don't think it's mined or anything. It's just, there's a fence and there's a bunch of signs. They basically say, if you come in here, we can shoot you. They probably wouldn't, but they can. And that was the same kind of warning that people got at the gate. You know, it's like, you know, if you want to you want to come stand out there, that's your business, because I think it's run by the Park Service beyond the actual perimeter of the installation. But if you start going on their territory, you're going to have a bad day. But as you probably read, I've seen different numbers. I've seen 40 people showed up, 150 people showed up. Washington Post said 2,000 people. It probably depended on where you were, because I think the 2,000 figure included the Alien Music Festival, where they're calling it the Alien Stock down
right,
the road.
Right.
But they said that, you know, the people were over there chatting up the Park Service guards and having a good time, and they were being friendly, and it turned out okay. It's just good that it wasn't tens of thousands of people, because right. that could have been iffy.
Yeah, and I saw some of the footage, you know, because obviously, you know, the news covered it, you know, and I saw some of the footage, and there didn't seem to be a whole lot of people, and you know, a lot of the vendors were mad because I guess they had the festival and they closed down a day early, and they were like, "What am I going to do?" Because they were so excited.
They had all their T-shirts.
Yeah,
right?
They got their T-shirts and they got their alien masks and their little trinkets that they were going to sell. And not, I mean, it was, you know, it was really not as many people even remotely showed up as they had hoped.
It was kind of like when I went up to the eclipse in 2017 in Oregon, and this town, which was just a couple dozen miles off the, or not even that much off the center point of the shadow. You know, we're going down the main street, and there are banquet tables lined up on both sides of the main street, this tiny town with people with T-shirts and eclipse glasses, and eclipse beer and eclipse coffee and all this stuff. I mean, they were set up for hundreds of thousands of people to come through, and there's this little trickle of traffic, and myself and my kid and a friend of mine driving down there, and all these people with stacks of stuff that you can see is the joke sign of, like, you know, $10 crossed out, $5 crossed out.
Yeah.
It was kind of depressing. So I think that happened here, too. And they canceled one music festival. The responsible guy canceled it. And the other one said, well, we'll still give it a shot. But, you know, they got a few hundred people. But, I mean, I think, you know, one thing I'd say good about it, and I think that was pointed out in the article you sent me the link to, is there was kind of a coming together of like minds.
Yeah.
And they were there for fun. It was kind of like an extraterrestrial Burning Man, just really small, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. But, no, I, you know, a couple of the articles that I was interested in was, despite the low turnout and not as, you know, because people were like, oh, God, you know, thousands of people are going to show up. They're going to raid Area 51. This is going to be insane. It's going to be nuts. And it just turned out not to be that. But despite the fact of the low turnout, what I read is that, you know, you said like-minded people were there. Friendships were made. People had a really good time. And it was a really fun event for all the people, you know, the small amount of people that went. But they made sort of some lasting friendships and some bonding. And, so it seemed like it was a nice time for the people who showed up.
You and I should have decided to meet there. And Budweiser, never one to miss an opportunity, did promise free beer to any aliens that made it out of the base.
I did not hear that. You got to, that's fantastic. Budweiser offered free beer to aliens. There was kind of a really kind of a wonderful thing that was written in the Washington Post about someone's you know, some of the real people that went. And, you know, the people that they made, the friends that they made along the way. It's a wonderful piece that we sent you the link to. And I think a lot of people should read that. And it's kind of fun. And, you know, I mean, it's easy to make fun of, you know, the conspiracy people and, you know, like, oh, Area 51, there's an alien there, if you don't believe that sort of thing. But just to see that they are, in fact, human beings who want to bond and make friends just like everybody else does. It's kind of a really fun piece to read.
Yeah, even beyond the music festival, there was a lot of people playing music on their blasters and dancing and, you know, in silver LeMay spacesuits and all that. I can't wear those, but the other people that were there can.
Yeah.
And they said, I think you read, they parked their RVs next to each other and they'd hang out and sit and talk. The thing is, if you spend much time out there, I mean, at night, the sky is spectacular because you can see everything, probably even all those new SpaceX satellites going overhead in a flock.
Yeah.
But the daytime, it's this bleak, windy, this time of year, hot, nasty, dry, plantless, just billiard table flat expanse. So you're either staring off the distance drooling or you're talking to somebody else. So I think that really does kind of, you know, enhance those friendships because there isn't much distraction out there.
That's true. You know, and, you know, when people were describing this and what could happen when the whole thing, you know, when the whole thing broke, I pictured in my head, you know, you mentioned the movie Contact, which is a movie that I absolutely love.
Yeah, I did too.
But you know, it's such a great movie, and I always, you know, when I was thinking about what could happen at Area 51, I was thinking about all of the people that showed up for what was going to be the launch. You know, and as Jodie Foster is driving through, and then there's the evil Jake Busey who's out, who's preaching, and all the people who have showed up. That's what I pictured maybe Area 51 was going to turn out to be, was like that sequence in Contact.
Ah, yeah. If only they had gotten the numbers, we could have seen something impressive there.
I wish Jake Busey would have shown up. That's the only thing.
Was it Jake or Gary?
No, Jake. It was his son. Jake Busey was the guy. Jake Busey's the guy who planted the bomb. He was the terrorist.
Yeah.
He was also the guy who pretended to be the preacher. That's Jake Busey. That's Gary Busey's son. I had him on the show.
Not quite as hacked up looking as his dad.
No. And he's also not nearly as crazy as his dad. Rod, did I ever tell you I spent about a week hanging out with Gary Busey for a full week?
No. Why?
Oh, he was in town shooting a movie called Rookie of the Year, a baseball movie that was filmed here in Chicago
and
involved the Chicago Cubs. He played a pitcher on the Cubs, and he was in town for a few weeks to film the movie. And I met him at China Club, of all places. I was dating a girl who really liked to go clubbing, which is not my thing. And we went into the private area because she was very attractive, and I had no business being with her because she was so hot. And we were able to get into the VIP room, and Gary Busey was there. And I just quietly went up and I said, "Listen, I don't want to bother you, but I just want to say that I'm a big fan of yours, and I absolutely loved you in Point Break." And as soon as I mentioned Point Break, his eyes lit up like a slot machine, and he went, "Point Break, Point Break, that movie changed my damn life." And then he just started telling me stories about Point Break, and then we started to, and he took a liking to me, and he gave me his phone number where he was staying at the Westin across the street from the Hancock building, and we hung out for like 6 days straight. And I don't know, I can't, in however you think hanging out with Gary Busey for six nights straight is, double that. That's all.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, and I had Jake Busey on the show to promote a movie, and he was in studio, and I was interviewing him, and I told him, you know, I ended up hanging out with your dad for like six nights in a row back in 1992, and Jake Busey just goes, "Oh God,"
he said, "I'm sorry."
Yeah, and he just looked at me, and he went, "Oh God," and I said, "Yeah, I got some stories," and he said, "Oh God, I bet you do," and so, but anyway, all right, we got a break. Rod, hang on, okay.
All right.
Rod Pyle is with us. The Area 51 thing was underwhelming for most people, but the people who did go had a great time. So good. Good for them. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news. No, not the news. We're going to come back and talk more with Rod. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. There's a starman waiting in the sky. Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, make it your request, dude. That's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Today marks the anniversary of the first episode of the Brady Bunch. And so we're going to talk about the Brady Bunch and then bust out some of our favorite and least favorite families on TV. You know, as we were just talking about Area 51, love talking about conspiracy theories, and we got a bunch of those that we're going to get to and talk about some of your favorites as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on 720 WGN. All right. Rod Pyle joins us usually once a month to talk all things space and outer space related. Lots of stories to talk about. Rod also saw the Brad Pitt movie Ad Astra, and we'll get his thoughts on that and much more. And if you have a question or a comment about outer space-related issues, you can text us or call us at 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. So can I let my age just hang out there for one moment?
Okay.
Okay, so TV families.
Yes.
Probably one of my least favorites. I wasn't a Brady Bunch fan, but I was probably kind of beyond the age curve slightly. But Space Family Robinson on Lost in Space.
Oh, sure.
Pretty pathetic. I mean, as a kid, I was a fan, right?
Yeah.
Especially because I saw the pilot. And in the pilot, which was black and white,
yes,
Dr. Smith, the shrieking banshee who yeah. used to run around with his curlers all a dither,
right,
was a real badass.
Yes.
And then the series comes along and he turns this the kind of foppish, weird, the Butler did it kind of guy.
Right.
It's like, what happened to him? He was this, you know, we were supposed to believe, I think he was a Russian agent or something.
Right.
And, you know, he programmed the robots, killed people and all this.
Yeah, he was supposed to be a total bad guy that was there to sabotage everything that they were doing on their, you know, on the mission. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh no, not me, take the boy. He was doing,
right.
And it was just ridiculous. But yeah, you know, like you, Rod, when I was a kid, I loved Lost in Space. I loved it.
And then, God bless you.
And as an adult, I went back and watched it, and I don't know, the budget for that show was like $7. The special effects and the sets were awful. But there's,
oh my Lord.
But I still have a sentimental attachment to it, because as a kid, it was a show that I loved. And, you know, you can still watch it here on, you can watch it here on MeTV on Saturday nights. And so, you know, it's still a lot of fun to go back and watch it. But, yeah, no, I agree.
It is, and I met years later. I was taking a directing class, this kind of master class that UCLA had, and I did realize the guy that was teaching, who had done a bunch of really great TV and a few movies. I mean, he was a very fine director. I'm looking at his bio, and it's like Lost in Space is on there. So I made those before, but I went up to him after the third or fourth class, and he was pretty brusque. You know, he used to give us a lot of jabs and a lot of drubbing because he figured better to get it here than out of the real world, which he was right. So I went up and kind of sheepishly said, I just have one question. Why Lost in Space? And he looked at me and smiled and he said, alimony payments. And I
went, oh, alimony okay. payments.
But we got to talking and I said, you know, when you guys really lost me was the episode where the aliens had black stockings pulled over their heads and white sequin top hats, you know? I mean, really? And he said, we literally, you know, we do script revisions because we couldn't afford what had been written. And he said, we would literally go around the lot going through the dumpsters just to pick out whatever we could find and rewrite based on what they yanked in. And I thought, yeah, that's got some class, in a way.
Yeah, you know? And you know what? That you know, judging upon, you know, watching the show, that doesn't surprise me in the least that they were running around, you know, dumpster diving in order to get costumes and props. That just the way, and that's the way the show feels too. But I mean, you know, it's got Dr. Smith, and you know the lead, Will Robinson. That I was around that age when I watched the show.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like he was my identifier. Like Billy Mumy was like the kid I was like, oh, he's the coolest because he's in, you know, he's doing this. And it has one of the most iconic robots in science fiction history.
What
you know?
A great robot. Yeah,
completely great. Yeah, but I still, I don't know. And then what did you think of the, the movie version where Gary Oldman played Dr. Yeah. Smith? Yeah.
Not a fan. And yeah. And I tried to watch the series reboot.
Netflix.
Came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was okay, but I just couldn't stick with it. It got a little too, you know, they're trying to be interesting. Dr. Smith is a psychotic woman.
Yeah.
And I think there was some, not a transgender, but a gay couple or something. And, you know, they were doing a lot of nods towards modernity, which I appreciated.
Right.
And the robot was kind of cool. And it was much more deeply scripted and so forth. But it just didn't get me. I'm still waiting, and we only have a couple more months for that next season of The Expanse. Because I think under Amazon, the way they spend money on television, when I was working on Deep Space Nine, I think the average episode was $800,000 or something.
Yeah.
And a big one was $1.3 million. And I was watching Carnival Row last month, I thought was quite good.
Yeah.
They must be spending $7 or $8 million an episode on that show. They gotta be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just so beautiful.
Yeah, I've not watched it. But I mean the commercials and the trailers look pretty great. So,
man, I'm never ahead of you on watching stuff. What's going on?
There's a lot to watch. I don't know. There's, you know,
are you working every night or something?
Yeah, I am. I don't know how that happened, but yeah, I'm working every night.
Okay.
Yeah, which I'm happy to be. And but you know, I will say this: as far as the reboot on Netflix of Lost in Space, I watched it. I got through it all the way, and I thought it was kind of interesting. But I really liked Parker Posey. I did. I thought Parker Posey. I thought Parker Posey was really great. And I thought that casting and that twist on Dr. Smith was kind of interesting. But I'm a big Parker Posey fan, so...
Well, and anything, you know, after the original Dr. Smith, anything is a relief. as a young man, I remember him being left alone with Will by the campfire on planet 14, thinking, is that really appropriate, the way he acts, to leave him alone with that young boy? And then the robot got so weird, where, you know, it was playing the guitar with its claw.
Right.
And then another time it's saying, Will, hold my claw, I'm scared.
Right.
And I thought, come on, you guys. This is worse than worse camp than Batman. Yeah. This is just way off the rails.
Right.
But Rod, here we are, way off the rails. Yes, sir.
Rod, hang on. Rod Pyle is with us. Everybody hold on. We got some texts coming in, some calls coming in, questions that are space related for Rod Pyle, and we'll get to those right after the news, which is up next. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has your opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran and the gang at 6 for your morning drive. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And we are going to be talking about conspiracy theories a little bit later on, as well as TV families and the Brady Bunch. All coming up, and we all want you to join us. Talk or text at 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is with us right now, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. He is an outer space expert, and if you have any questions or concerns or anything like that about space, 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Let's see. We got a caller here. Here's Lulu on WGN. Go ahead, Lulu.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Rod. Hey, I'm going to wander off the path a little bit, but I have two questions, and then I'll hang up. If I could get an explanation of black holes for dummies, and then the second part is, what is your opinion of what's happening in the Milky Way's black hole? They discovered that it really lit up a while back, like by 75%. Increase in light emitting from it, and maybe what does that mean? So I will listen for your answer.
All right. Well, thank you, Lulu. Okay.
Thanks.
So black holes for dummies first, Ron.
Yeah. So, oh boy, this goes back a ways. My astrophysics are from the 70s, before we even really knew very much what they were. But large star that collapses and goes beyond neutron star stage, and after it goes supernova, and creates this kind of gravity well in space that sucks things in, and you have an event horizon around that where essentially time kind of stops, at least from the perspective of the outside, as I recall. And there are these divots in space-time, and we don't really know where they go, but I know there's been, in the last couple of years, there's been way more theories about stuff that I've seen probably in the 10 years prior. And then we had that incredible image from that, assembled from the ground telescopes, if you remember, from a couple of months ago, that image of a big orange ring, it looked like
right.
a big orange kind of a smoke ring.
Right, right.
It was a black hole. But that's kind of it. And as far as the one in the Milky Way, I caught that headline, but I was so caught up in all the Apollo 11 stuff, I didn't have a chance to really read it. What makes me nervous about, I mean, black holes are bad, but then you get things like those spinning stars that emit gamma rays, you know? And if some reason one of those gets a bad mood that's not too far away and shifts, it can wipe out life on one side of the planet in one very quick and bad afternoon. So that and asteroids scared me a lot more than the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. But I did spot that headline. I thought, ooh, that's exciting. I got to get back to that.
Yeah. Okay. It was such a big deal when that image of the black hole, remember we talked about when the image of the black hole made all the news and everything, and everybody was really suddenly fascinated with black holes.
Well, and they're working on another one, and I think that one took a number of years. It was thousands of images. So they're working on another one that they say is going to be, I think, 10 times as sharp or something, so we'll actually be able to see some detail. And, you and I are old enough to remember a time before digital.
Yeah.
Right. Where, film effects were done by layering and multi-printing and all that kind of stuff. And if you were doing this kind of astronomy work, it was multiple exposures that had to be blended into one exposure through physical means with optical printers and so forth. Now, digital technology has just changed everything so much And there are people that take it for granted, but if you're old enough to remember a time before that when you had to go to the library and pull out that 3-foot-long file drawer to find a book, it's really just astonishing how much our world's changed in such a short time.
Yeah, that is. And I also remember that when, you know, they started, you know, when they, that image of the black hole was shared with everyone and it made all the news and everything, then suddenly we all had to, like, reevaluate how that stupid Disney movie almost got it right.
Well, yeah, except for at the end, and I've complained about this before, but if I remember, and I saw it twice, once here and then once
right.
in Thailand, because I was desperate. I told you that story. I was desperate right. to see any film in English,
right?
Because in 1980, there weren't many. And I remember at the end, even the second time, thinking, yes, this is every bit as hideous as I remember the first time.
Yeah.
Because the black hole looked like a tunnel made out of like black fuzz, a tinfoil tunnel. And weren't those angels at the far end or something?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Angels or moths or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are you guys thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, this is beyond, this is worse than Lost in Space.
Yeah.
You had money. And the only good thing in that movie was Maximilian Schell and the robot. You know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree. All right.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Okay.
815 area code says, I know there's a lot of space junk out there. Does Rod know how much junk is orbiting our Earth? And when will it start falling away that we will really truly notice?
There's a number, it's in the I think, many millions of tons, if not more, because we've been shooting stuff up there since the 50s, and the Air Force tracks everything down to about the size of a softball with fairly high accuracy. They can track smaller, but there's a limit, of course.
Yeah.
And the problem is, even small things are dangerous. So the space shuttle years ago had a chunk of paint, a fleck of paint smaller than a dime, hit its window going at high speed in the wrong direction and almost took out the front pane of glass. Now, there's multiple layers, but that's how high energy that stuff
yeah.
is. So if you're talking about a paint chip doing that, if you've got something the size of a marble or a golf ball traveling at 17,500 miles an hour in the direction that you're not, then you go bye-bye. So there's a ton of junk up there. Then there's inactive satellites, active satellites, pieces of spacecraft. In terms of the fate of that stuff, there are a number of programs, different countries, some by corporations, other by governments, to try and figure out ways to bring it down or send it higher, but preferably bring it down. So there's an electromagnetic drag system the Japanese have been experimenting with that would actually sort of pull the stuff down indirectly. They've looked at nets. They've looked at laser fire to hit them. They've looked at big, sticky kind of meta fabric surfaces. So there's a bunch of different ways to do it. They're all very ingenious. What would be really great, though, and modern satellites have to have a deorbit mechanism. So if you're going to, even Elon Musk with his constellation of what's soon going to be 14,000 communication satellites up in low Earth orbit, each one has to have a system of getting back down once it fails, because they don't want that stuff just living up there. But the really cool thing, if you can figure it out, is you've got all these millions of tons of metal up there already. So if you want to build something up there, you collect the stuff and you melt it down and you separate out the impurities, and you can start making a lot of things on somebody else's dime, because some government like the USSR or the US spent millions of dollars launching that thing back in the day, and it's just up there waiting to be used. So that would be the cool thing.
Wow. Okay. All right. God, that's a lot of stuff up there, Rod.
Yeah, and it really, if you've ever seen the graphs, it looks like an electron cloud. There's so much of it. And I don't know if we're going to talk about it later, but this thing that SpaceX and now Amazon
yeah.
and OneWeb and a bunch of other companies want to do is launch all these low altitude, because communication and at this point internet satellites, the few that there are, mostly fly up at geosynchronous altitude, which is high enough to stay in one spot from our perspective. It you know, orbits at the same speed the Earth does, the Earth turns, and that's like 24,000 miles or so. But these new ones, these constellations that these guys are putting up of thousands and thousands of these things, will be flying at 320 to 380 miles. So the idea is it takes a lot less time for that signal to go back and forth, and they can be smaller because they're not sitting out there at 24,000 miles away. But there's got to be a lot of them because they're constantly moving overhead and they're handing off to each other. So the good thing is you've got like 90% of the planet or more will be covered by available broadband signal if you can afford a $200 ground station, they're claiming. So even in the middle of Africa, you'd be able to get internet, and that broadens education and the international conversation, peace efforts and all that. It also, of course, gives Coke and Nike and Chanel lots of other places to advertise and sell, which is what will happen. But, you know, now you've got a lot more traffic control up there. So all these companies are going to have to manage and track all their satellites. If any of them threaten anybody else's asset, you have to move it because it's your responsibility.
Wow.
That's a lot of work.
That is a lot, man. Wow. Geez.
So, you know, there could be a career in both our futures, sitting at home staring at the screen, being a controller of one of these satellites for SpaceX.
I think that sounds great. Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know? Just, I see something up there. Oops, sorry.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rod Pyle is with us. He joins us monthly to talk all things space-related. He's an author, journalist, and he's a space expert. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiCiglio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? We're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. So Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, space expert, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, joins us once a month to talk space issues and space stories and stuff like that. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
Hey, I wanted to mention, I think congratulations are in order because you're going to be working on a documentary with Nat Geo about the right stuff, correct?
Yeah, so I worked on their Apollo 11 film last year, which was great fun. Really nice company, a bunch of guys out here in Los Angeles in the West Valley. And that turned out really well. And so they got another contract to do this doc on the right stuff. And as you probably know, National Geographic is doing a live-action dramatic reinterpretation of the right stuff with Leonardo DiCaprio. So I guess this is a documentary companion piece to that. But the thing that I thought would be so cool about talking to you about it is we're looking for materials from that era because this is all kind of told in the zen of the moment. So it's told as if you're in that time.
Right.
So there's none of this voiceover of God stuff and all that.
Right.
So we're reaching out. If anybody has got materials dating back from that time, so let's say your uncle or your grandfather was, you know, working on the launch pad or, you know, slinging hash at the cafeteria but got a picture with Gus Grissom or one of the Mercury astronauts. We're going from before Mercury up through Gemini,
right.
So it's that period before Apollo. We're reaching out to people, so if they've got something they want to get in contact, my email is coolspacenews@gmail.com. That's coolspacenews, just those three words, no periods or gaps. @gmail.com, and you know, if this stuff can be used, I'll be compensated for it by the company.
So you're just looking for like audio recordings and pictures, home movies, anything like that.
Yeah, you covered it. So stills, you know, print slides, audio recordings on a cassette or reel to reel, or even some people had home record makers back in that day. Home movies, 8mm, 16, Super 8, it doesn't matter. And just anything that records a piece of that history that's related to the space race era is of potential interest. And
okay.
I think it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun because it's such an exciting time to be dealing with. And to have this constraint of telling it in the moment makes it really challenging because you can't, you know, I've done a lot of documentaries, but we're always able to kind of back off and default to the voiceover. You know, I don't know what to do here. I'll write some voiceover, and you write it in real time and you read it and then, you know, you go get it finished later. Yeah, you can't do that here. You got to cut to something from that time that explains it. So it'll be really neat.
Oh, that's great. Sounds great. And again, it's coolspacenews.com. No, coolspacenews.com.
Coolspacenews@gmail.com.
Coolspacenews@gmail.com. If you have any of that kind of stuff related to that period during the space program, coolspacenews@gmail.com. Well, congrats, Rod.
Thank you very much for that.
Fun.
Yeah. Hey, well, and you know, working in TV makes enough scratch that I can write a couple of more books for penurious wages.
All right. We got a couple more texts. We got a caller here. It's Donald. Go ahead,
sure.
Donald.
Hi. Yeah. This is sort of a follow-up on what you were talking about, the space junk. I read a Bourne novel a recent Bourne novel that basically had somebody using the Kessler effect, which they said, where if you detonate a warhead into a certain kind of certain synchronous orbit in the lower level of a certain satellite, you could plot that it's going to hit into this one and this one and start a chain reaction that'll create a barrier from the lower orbit. You know, they'll keep it from reaching a higher orbit, so it'll disrupt communications and also spaceflight because of the high velocity attained in the lower orbits.
Yeah. So, did you see Gravity, perchance, the movie?
Did you see Gravity?
No, I didn't.
No, he didn't.
Okay. So that was a big part of that. So even without a deliberate detonated warhead up there. There is a body of theory, this Kessler effect, that people think that even if just another spacecraft goes out of control, if it's big enough, like, say, the size of the shuttle or a space station, that these impacts could start happening and that you get this out-of-control kind of random kinetic nightmare storm going up there, and it just spreads and spreads and spreads, and you get this out-of-control chain reaction. It's all theoretical, of course. And how long it would last is anybody's guess, but there is so much stuff up there that apparently it's a very real, at least in terms of the physics of it, a real possibility. And yeah, it could create this kind of barrier that would be very difficult to transit for a while, and that's why people are trying to slow down the proliferation of this stuff, which is why people got very upset last year when India launched that satellite interceptor, that ASAT weapon test. And they said, oh, don't worry, you know, it's a low altitude, all that stuff will come down in a few hours to a few days, and a lot of it's still up there. So these things are hard to predict and control, and, you know, the U.S. and Russia have had more practice at it than anybody else, but even we don't get it right all the time. So the less of that we can have up there, the better.
Oh, okay. All right, Donald, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Donald.
Yeah. Here's a text here from our good friend Doc, who says, I have heard of a rock formation on the surface of Mars that strongly resembles Stonehenge, dubbed Marshenge. There are theories of how this could have occurred naturally, but the arrangement is extremely similar to Stonehenge. What do you know about this?
Not much, although I tracked for years when I was writing my last two Mars books. I tracked those sightings as they came up because I knew it was going to be part of the conversation. And there's been pictures where they thought they saw Bigfoot, arrowheads, fossils, an artillery piece, of course, famously the face on Mars. And, you know, of course, that conversation usually leads to, okay, NASA's covering something up, right? Because
right.
If we saw it, we can discuss it. Well, and I remember talking to the lead scientist on the Curiosity mission, because I followed him around for about a year working on that book I did called Curiosity. And I said, you know, they just got another Bigfoot sighting on Mars. He smiled. He said, yeah. And I expect him to kind of poo-poo it, because, you know, this guy's a PhD working at Caltech and JPL.
Yeah.
He said, you know what? I love that stuff. And I said, why? And he said, because if we actually have a dinosaur femur moment up there, my budget explodes. It would be 10 times in a week and 100 times a year. So if I find a trilobite or an old Chevy carcass or something up there, my budget just goes through the roof, and I could do incredible science and exploration and probably send people up there. Why wouldn't I want that? I said, yeah, that's a pretty good point. I think some of the spooky stuff is where you see these parts of the landscape which may be what he's talking about, where they have kind of a soft, like a clay bed with, you know, more calcified vertical rocks in it or something. And over the millennia, wind or water has worn away the softer stuff. You get these really weird formations left. It's almost like a molding process, right, except in reverse. And you get what they call dragon's teeth, and that's what was tearing up the wheels of the rover for a while. But you get things that look like wrenches and hammers and socks and all kinds of stuff left over from this erosive process, and it's just millions and millions and hundreds of millions of years of wind and water. But, Marshenge is one I'm going to have to check out. That actually sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, no, that I was, you know, when I hadn't heard about that until Doc sent in that text. That sounds kind of cool. I would love to see that if there's something on that look. And then, of course, you know, because it, like, looks like Stonehenge, you know, again, Rod, of course, you know, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories a little bit later on. That's ripe for a conspiracy theory.
Well, this looks like a hillock or a hummock, a small hill with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 roughly circular rocks on it. and I'm only seeing it from overhead because, you know, it's a lot better if you can see those things with some relief off to the side. But the best pictures, they look, again, like these rocks that are cemented into the soil after it's been eroded away.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they got drop shadows and everything. What I don't see is scales. That'd be kind of interesting to check out.
It's cool because considering, you know, like the theories behind Stonehenge being put together by aliens and stuff, it's just going to even further that that theory right there. It's like they've stopped at Mars, they've stopped at Earth, they're going to stop at other places and leave their stones behind.
Well, you leave your stones behind. I don't want this. and there was something. Oh, it was just the other day. There was a piece, a new paper release saying that Venus, they think Venus may have had a temperate atmosphere that could have supported open bodies of water and stuff a couple billion years ago, maybe 2 to 3 billion years ago. And that it just got this runaway, you know, warning for us here on Earth, this runaway greenhouse effect that just destroyed it.
Yeah.
But more and more, there seems to be this body of theory saying, you know, we think there's a chance that advanced civilizations may have popped up throughout the galaxy and beyond a long time ago.
Right.
And just didn't make it. We're kind of late to the party because of the age of our star and all that.
Right.
If that's the case, that starts you worrying a little bit, doesn't it?
Cause yeah.
Like technical civilizations tend to wipe themselves out. Well, that would be unfortunate.
Yeah. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Rod's with us. Rod Pyle is with us, space expert. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got more to talk about, a lot more to talk about with Rod, and we'll do it after the news, which is up after this. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Thursday morning, so it's a triple play Thursday, one artist, three songs. That'll be coming up later on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 312-981-7200. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to be talking about the Brady Bunch, because today marks the debut, the premiere of the Brady Bunch 50 years ago. So we're going to talk about the Brady Bunch and then some of the best and worst TV families. And conspiracy theories, we'll jump into that too on this Thursday morning. And anytime you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and space expert. If you have a space comment or question, it's 312-981-7200. And Rod, welcome back.
Hey.
Hey, so on this date, in 1996, Shannon Lucid returned to Earth. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the importance of that?
Oh, boy. I'm trying to remember. You didn't send me that one.
Oh, I didn't?
You switch hit it on me.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
I know Amin Collins because she was at the last conference I was at, so I read up on her because she was the first female shuttle commander and did the docking with Mir, and more importantly was just the nicest, most genuine astronaut. I mean, there are a lot of them that are nice, but she was just incredible. But I'm going to have to.
Okay, well,
let's get back to Shannon Lucid because I got to look her up.
Oh, okay. Well, Shannon Lucid returned back to Earth on this date in 1996. So
from how long was she up?
It said on March 23rd.
Oh, she did 223 days total. She was up there a long time.
Yeah, and it said, but on March 23rd, 1996, Lucid transferred to Mir and from the same space shuttle for a planned 5-month stay.
Okay, she was one of the ones with the that was a big deal because that was our first real bit of space detente with Russia, because that was after the Soviet Union fell.
Right.
So she, we'd done the, you know, the Apollo Soyuz thing back in 75, which was docking an Apollo capsule, Soyuz capsule, and they shook hands and ate borscht paste and hung out for a couple of days and then came home. But it was kind of a, you know, it was using up Apollo hardware and it was kind of a nice thing. But after having the Skylab space station up and doing the whole lunar exploration thing, it was kind of like if you were, you know, just a sideline observer like I was at times, like, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
But the shuttle Mir thing was great because it was like the peak of our technology for that time, because we hadn't done a modular space station yet, with their first modular space station, which, you know, the Soviet Union was really good at making space stations. They weren't as big as Skylab.
Yeah.
for as the ISS, but they worked pretty well. And if you look at the close-up pictures of them, they were scary primitives, but they worked, and it all worked. And their space capsules worked, and the rocket worked. So yeah, so you're right. Yeah, that was
she
her.
She was also the first American woman to live in a space station, according to this that I'm looking at.
And born in Shanghai, China.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Of missionary parents, yeah.
All right.
So, hey, this is my third question flunk for the evening. I think I'm setting a record on your show. I didn't know Mars hands, didn't really know the black hole answer, and now Shan loses.
Oh, that's all right. Now, you mentioned Amazon and SpaceX. The space race could connect the entire world to the Internet. This is something that you mentioned a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
So, like I said, it's these low-altitude orbits. SpaceX's are about, I think, 380 miles. They deploy lower than that, then they eventually transition them up there. And it's this idea of low-latency, easy-access broadband for the entire planet. So SpaceX is planning to put up between 12,000 and 14,000 in the next couple of years. They've launched, I think, 60 so far. 57 of them are still working. Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' space company, is planning to do something similar. OneWeb is another company, and there's a bunch of smaller ones. Some of them are specialty operations. But the idea is, of course, they're all proprietary, so once you sign up, it's like cable. You sign up for one company, you're stuck with them. But the idea is that anywhere on the planet you are, you can get broadband if you have a ground station, probably about the size of a large briefcase with a small dish, a couple hundred bucks, might be smaller than that. Over time, certainly it will be. And so, you know, on at one level, it's like, great, you know, we've got fast broadband. It's a much higher rate in terms of speed than we're getting on our cable system or our DSL systems. So that's cool. You do have to have an antenna outside, so there's going to have to be some finagling to do there. But the real excitement, for me anyway, and I was interviewing this multi-billionaire named Steve Jurvetson, who invested a bunch of money in SpaceX years ago. It was an incredible interview, and he's this brilliant, passionate, incredibly wealthy guy who invests in this kind of tech. And he was bouncing off the walls. I was talking to about this, saying, think of all the potential Einsteins out there. You've got these huge swaths of humanity, billions of people. I think 2.5 or 3 billion people now are not wired in.
Yeah.
Who aren't part of that conversation. How many of them are potential geniuses? How many of them could benefit from more advanced education techniques by not having to trudge 10 miles to the village schoolhouse? But, and you know, is that going to happen? In some cases, yeah. In some cases, probably not. And as I was saying earlier, you know, when I was in grad school at Stanford studying communication, when the first rollout of the internet was kind of really getting big, and I remember we were having all these theoretical discussions about, oh, it'll broaden the scope of human conversation. We'll have all these humble intellectual conversations and all that. I was the only guy in the seminar that said, no, capitalism hates a vacuum. It's going to become the playground for Coke, Pepsi, and Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
And these academics looked at me like I was a creature. Well, guess what? Yeah, there's been an expansion of the public sphere a little bit, but most of it's advertising and marketing capitalism because we're good at it. So that'll be part of it, too. But it is exciting, and it's going to be a big deal. One downside is astronomers are complaining on any given night, in a dark sky, you can see between 3,500 and 5,000 stars, depending on, you know, which hemisphere you're looking at and so forth. This is going to have tens of thousands of new stars up there. Some will be dimmer than others, but it's going to make it really hard. I mean, for just a passive sky watcher like me, it's going to be great because there's going to be all these moving fireflies up there. It's kind of neat. But for an astronomer, it's going to be a nightmare because they're going to have to think constantly crossing through their field of vision.
Oh, yeah, wow. Hey, did you ever think back years and years ago that, like Amazon and SpaceX and all these rich guys would be doing what they're doing now? And when it started happening, were you skeptical about it?
No, I was really excited, but I didn't see it coming because I heard of Musk and then later, a little bit later, Bezos talking about it, even though he started earlier, he was very quiet about it. I kind of thought, you know, building rockets is really harder than these guys think. And it was. I mean, it took Musk almost a decade to get anything going that was really working out, which is a long time when you're spending that kind of money.
Yeah.
And Bezos has been even slower. But they've both been, especially SpaceX, his success has been spectacular given where he came from. So, you know, I, like you, probably watched Destination Moon and other movies about you know, Mr. Industrialist is going to build his rocket.
Right.
And, oh, here comes the military, and they're going to take it over, or the government shows up to help out, or what have you.
Right.
And there is a kid thinking, that's silly. Only NASA and the Russians can build rockets, and it's really hard, and it takes 363 feet of Saturn V to launch this little tiny capsule and bring it home and all that. Well, you look at what Musk is doing with Starship, which is going to be way bigger than Saturn V on its booster, carrying 80 to 100 people out to the moon and Mars at the time. Looks like it can probably work if he can figure it out. So, yeah, I'm stunned.
Yeah.
I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm completely godsmacked and kind of sideswiped by it and really happy about that.
Yeah. It's great. It's a fun time to follow this stuff now. It really is, you know.
It is, and I'm so glad that I'm still alive to see it, cuz I really kind of felt let down after the whole Apollo thing was over. And that, you know, the shuttle was cool, the space station's great, but it's not out there.
Yeah.
And I don't care if it's NASA going to the moon and beyond, or and to Mars, or SpaceX, or Bezos, or China, but as long as somebody does it, there's a part of me, I think our generation has a little bit more nationalism maybe than the current one. Part of me really would like to see the United States pull it off, but you know what? The Chinese are really putting their backs into it, and they may deserve to win. We'll see.
Okay. All right. Another call coming in. Here's Carrie on WGN. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Just a similar question to one of the last callers, and this may be out of your realm, and that's okay. For dummies, and scientifically, I'm not a dummy. I'm a chemist, and I've taken a lot of physics and such, but I kind of didn't pay attention to a lot. But I'm fascinated, in order to really explore the rest of the universe, at least where we live, we're never going to be able, probably, based on physics, we're never going to be able to build a vehicle that goes the speed of light. And even if we did, it would take us 1,000 years to get somewhere that we wanted to go. So the only other alternative is like wormholes. For dummies, can you give like a 2-second wormhole explanation and what the theory is? And again, I know that's a little bit out of your, you know, expertise, but
yeah, I mean, as I think you're kind of alluding to, it's like a short circuit in space-time, right? So if you imagine space-time is as big as we always saw the classic illustrations in astrophysics classes back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Like the space-time is this rubber blanket, you fold it over, and there's a hole passing from one part to the other, and that gives you the shortcut through space. There's been so much time. I mean, when I was working on Trek, of course, there were people that would write in and say, you know, is it real? Does it really work? It's like, no, it's a fantasy. Last thing I read about wormholes was they can't work because basically you can't transit them as solid matter. But, you know, it beats me. But talking about interstellar travel, I would add a couple things. I'm on the board of an organization called Tau Zero Foundation, and that's what they've been studying for years. And we're just getting ready to step off and start raising a new fund. They've done this a couple times before, of probably non-NASA money to support 8 really breakthrough research groups that we've been looking at. We canvassed a lot of them. And there's some stuff out there that is surprisingly close to working, plasma magnets and things like this. For high-energy propulsion, we're not talking about speed of light. We're talking about a fraction of that. But if you're sending a robotic probe out to Proxima Centauri, which is 4.4 light years away, something like that, that is interesting. You know, it's going to take a long time to get there, probably 20 years, and it's going to take a long time for the pictures to get back, and you have to figure out a way to slow it down once you get there, which is hard. But, you know, getting the first images back of an exoplanet is going to be one of those life-defining moments for an awful lot of people.
All right.
That's cool.
Okay,
that's cool. That's great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. All right. Yeah, so make sure you live another 30 years so you get to see it. You're a chemist. You know how to figure that out.
Yeah.
And when you do figure it out, let Nick and I know, okay? Because I think we're heading for an early one.
Yeah. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, and we're going to continue talking a little bit about space here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me round again to fight. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here above downtown Chicago. Coming up, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Rod Pyle is with us. He is an author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. A couple more news stories, space stories to talk about here with Rod. And let's get Rod back on. Rod, welcome back.
Hey.
All right. What is this this story? How important is this story that the Senate bill offers $22.75 billion for NASA in 2020? That's got to be big, right?
Yeah, it's bigger than last year by about $1.2 billion. They were looking for more because they're trying to get this moon program done. So on the one hand, you got the president, the administration saying, okay, back to the moon by 2024. We know we said 2028 before, and now we want 2024. Get with it. Well, we need a rocket. We need to buy one for SpaceX or finish building the SLS, which we've been working on for a better part of a decade. And we need the Orion capsule finished and flown and tested and worked out. And we need to know we can put people in it. But, you know, those things are pretty close to being done. We need a lander, which is really not even started unless you count what Blue Origin has been doing. So that's got to be a fast prototype and build. And we need spacesuits because we haven't built a moon suit since the 1970s. So there's a lot of stuff that's really expensive to do, even with NASA's new routine of outsourcing to private companies and not doing it on this old cost-plus model they used to do with space and defense, but where you would get all these cost overruns and just pay them blindly. Now it's pay for performance. So these are fixed contracts, fixed-price contracts. But even with that, you need enough money to get it going. So the last thing I read, the NASA administrator was not very happy because he said, you know, you're kind of killing us here. You ask us to do this on one hand, and you don't give us enough money on the other. But, you know, I was looking at the way the dollars spin out. And, for instance, in that budget, we know there's at least $2 to $3 billion to continue operating the space station, which is getting old and expensive. So they'd like to start being able to get out of that pretty soon. But there's another $4 billion, again, for SLS and Orion, and we've been putting billions into this thing every year, like I said, for a better part of a decade, and it's, you know, it's way, way, way behind schedule. So there's a lot of people out there that kind of feel they ought to just give it up and just turn to SpaceX and Blue Origin and say, okay, here's a tenth that money, make it happen, and they would.
And how do they budget this money? Where's it going to go? Do you know?
Oh, it's split out. You know, each field center gets a certain amount, and JPL gets about a tenth of it, and then the directorates get various. So there's a science directorate, a human spaceflight directorate, and there's the people that do the weather and climate tracking and all that. So it's whittled into all these different areas. And then you've got like $112 million for education, which various parties keep trying to cut out, but the Senate keeps putting back because they feel it's important and NASA's good at it. And one of the things about NASA that's so impressive, if you just look at the history of the organization, is it's the only agency of its kind that I know of that has always taken everything it's learned and gotten and shared it with the public. So if you're a foreign power, like China, for instance, who's making big strides in space, or India, you know, you've got a real leg up by getting all this data from NASA. You've got engineering knowledge. You can see the results of their engine tests. You can see the results of their analysis of how things worked out when the spacecraft was flying, what they were doing up there. So that's a real gift to the world. Sometimes I think maybe a little bit more than the world deserves. But, so this money comes back in myriad ways. But, yeah, this budget is an important one, and I wish it was about another billion and a half higher.
Okay. All right. Well, as we talked when you first came on, you did see Brad Pitt's movie Ad Astra. I because of scheduling problems and things that happened over the weekend, I didn't get a chance to see it, but I'm so curious about it. And I also have a piece here about how one opinion piece that says that Ad Astra is one big shiny ad for Lockheed Martin.
Yeah. So I guess in the great tradition of product placement, I guess early on Lockheed Martin, the way I read it, offered, said, look, we'll advise you on the film because we know how to build spaceships like that. And they said, okay. The producer said, okay. And then the next thing you know, they're spending an unspecified amount of money to start labeling things. And, you know, Lockheed Martin is doing fine, but they haven't won as big in the space derby as they'd like. And Boeing got the Space Launch System and the Orion capsule. And, you know, Lockheed would like a piece of some of this action. They pitched the thing called Mars Base Camp, which was going to be a kind of a mini International Space Station that would transit out to Mars and stay in orbit there. That's not going anywhere. They pitched manned Mars landers that aren't happening yet. They're certainly interested in working on the moon landing project. So, you know, they've got to stay in the game. So how do you do that? Well, you get out there in front of the popular audience, say, look at all the cool stuff we do. And one way to do that is to hope that you're on a blockbuster movie with the proper labeling and designs. And people go, oh, I saw that great-looking rocket in that movie Ad Astra.
Right.
I don't know how this is going to do. You know, have you tracked the box office at all?
It had a disappointing opening, and it's going to drop. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to drop big time. Listen, when a movie version of Downton Abbey makes like $16 million more, that's not real good.
Well, this is just casual evidence, but I was in the theater on a Monday, admittedly, in the afternoon. But it was in a major metropolitan cinema, and I think with me there was an audience of six.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So what did you think?
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, you know, so visually it was stunning, as everybody says.
Yeah.
I thought Brad Pitt did an Oscar-level performance of this kind of constrained. It was a little bit like watching Ryan Gosling in First Man, this
sure.
constrained, emotionally crippled guy. He's on Earth, you know, his marriage isn't going well. We see flashbacks of how his wife is tired of dealing with this cold, removed man. So he's working up on this big antenna that's a SETI project, you know, for contacting aliens. And this pulse comes, and he gets knocked off, and then you have that terrifying descent from the sky. So that's action sequence number one. So we know there's a problem. So the big bad military pulls him in and says, hey, we think this is your dad who disappeared in this deep solar system mission 16 years ago to go out and try and find life on other worlds, because apparently you have to travel to the edge of the solar system to be able to look out into the galaxy, which we know isn't really true. But, you know, their conceit was it's closer to the heliosphere, the boundary between the solar wind and the outside. So if you're closer to it, you get a better view. I don't know. So out he goes. So dad went out and did that, disappeared. So now we find out, you know, secret military thing. Oh, guess what? Your dad's actually still around, and we think he's gone nuts.
Yeah.
So they want to send Brad out to the moon and then to Mars to contact dad. So he does a moon shuttle, kind of a cool thing. Gets to the moon station. It's got a Subway sandwich, and it's got the cowboy from Las Vegas, the hitchhiking sign. So there's some cute stuff there about commercialization, because,
right.
of course, that's what will happen.
Right.
And then it's time to drive over to the base to take off from Mars, and pirates attack because they're pirates on the moon. And why wouldn't they? It's never explained why they attack. We still don't know why these pulses are coming and what they have to do with his dad. We never really find out. So long and short of it is, he sneaks his way onto the Mars rocket because he's not supposed to go, because he's been unable to reach dad by radio, which, by the way, he sends a message out and then sits there and waits for a response. It's like, dude, didn't anybody tell you it takes 4.5 hours to get the message out to Neptune and 4.5 hours
right,
to get it back?
Right, right.
But it's the magic of movies, right? And if it's a good movie, you don't care. In this case, you kind of care. So he ends up accidentally killing a bunch of people on the rocket. Oops, sorry about that. Goes out and does not solve his daddy drama when he gets there.
Yeah.
But the visuals out by Neptune make the trip to theater worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, I was watching people nod off, and I was getting close myself. And I know a lot of people said they fell asleep in the film.
Yeah.
But if you can make it till that Neptune stuff, it's like seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey over again.
Yeah, well, that's a high compliment. What I heard was that visually it's amazing and that everybody should see it on the largest screen possible. So if you have the option to see it on IMAX or anything like that, that's the way you should see it. So,
yeah. And there's a lot more to say about it, but, you know, I don't want to give away too many things. But,
got it.
You know, basically, it's this kind of introverted, deeply psychological meditation on what love and family means, and his father abandoned him and pushes him away right up till the end.
Yeah.
And so Brad comes home and falls back in love with his wife.
There you go. Okay.
And that's a good thing.
Oh, it is a good thing. By the way, you're working on this documentary, a National Geographic documentary about the right stuff. So if anybody out there has anybody whose family members or you yourself worked during the Mercury and Gemini programs, and if you have any stuff that you would like to participate with, you like audio recordings, photos, home movies, that kind of stuff. Again, shout out the email address they should send it to if they want to be a part of this documentary.
CoolSpaceNews@gmail.com.
CoolSpaceNews.
Which also happens to be the name of my podcast. But yeah, that was the best address to use. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And everybody check out Rod Pyle Books. Rod, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you next month.
Thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Every time.
Rod Pyle's the best. We'll take a break. The news is coming up in 8 seconds.